www.thebeatnik.com. It's 9:06. Good morning.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Earlier this year, Governor Maggie Hassan called for a spirit of bipartisanship and collective problem-solving as lawmakers took up bills and weighed proposals. Now, Hassan and legislative leaders from both the Democratic majority House and the Republican-led Senate are again emphasizing compromise and progress on shared goals, primarily through a $10.7 billion state budget that increases funding for higher education and mental health services while avoiding new taxes or fees. But on some issues, common ground remains hard to find. The state budget did not include an expansion of New Hampshire's Medicaid program through the Affordable Care Act. Meanwhile, while the Northern Pass Project has proposed a new route through the North Country that its backers call a compromise, opponents of the hydropower project remain skeptical. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're taking a look at the biggest New Hampshire news stories of the week, and let's hear from you. What stories from the week's news stand out for you? What questions do you have about the state's newly passed laws or long-running debates? Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email with your questions or comments, exchange@nhpr.org, or send a question or comment through our Facebook page. We have some of our regular panelists here with us for the hour. Josh Rogers is NHPR's senior political reporter. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Brady.
Kevin Landrigan is with us, a longtime political reporter for the Nashua Telegraph. Great to see you as well, Kevin.
Same here.
And we're joined by Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Dean, welcome back.
Hi, good morning, Brady.
Well, let's start with the state budget. $10.7 billion, legislative leaders calling it a compromise, Democrats and Republicans, one that wound up passing pretty easily in the end. And I wanted to start by playing some clips from some of those legislative leaders. Here's a Democrat, David Pierce, talking about his reaction to what the state passed this week.
If our constituents stopped us on the street and asked, will the people of New Hampshire be better off because of this budget, I think the answer would fairly be yes. More people will be able to afford college. More families struggling with mental illness or developmental disabilities will get the help that they need, and they'll get it sooner. We will once again have resources to help families with troubled children. These are goals that our governor set for us in January, and we're going to deliver on them.
So that's Democratic State Representative David Pierce. And Josh Rogers, Democrats have been framing this as a victory for the priorities that Governor Hassan has been talking about since taking office.
They have, and it's been interesting to see the collective evolution on this budget. This was a budget that essentially stuck pretty much to what Senate Republicans ended up crafting, at least on the major questions of taxes. There are new taxes in this. There are revenue estimates that were what Republicans supported. There was not a moving forward with Medicaid expansion, which is what Republicans wanted. And, the dollar amount is basically what was in the Senate Republican proposal that was a proposal that Governor Hassan and Democrats were decrying, a matter of weeks ago.
And in fact, here's a clip now from the Senate's lead budget writer, Chuck Morse of Salem. Here's what he had to say about the state budget.
Senate Finance was proud of the work we did to craft the Senate's budget. We believe strongly that it was a responsible spending plan for the state of New Hampshire. Though some were quick to criticize our work for political purposes, I am pleased that given a couple of weeks and more careful study, they came to largely agree that ours was a thoughtful, balanced proposal that meets our state's needs within existing means. We welcome their newfound support.
Again, that's State Senator Chuck Morse, a Republican of Salem. And Kevin Landrigan, hearing what Josh Rogers had to say about this, is this a case where the budget is a true compromise, where Democrats and Republicans can each say, well, we got something out of the deal? Or is it simply really more of a Republican budget that Democrats said this is as good as it's going to get for us and we'll have to try again another time?
I think what the Senate Republicans really successfully did this time was to essentially agree with the House on a lot of spending levels in the past. I think with a very narrow Republican majority, Senate President Peter Bragdon was very anxious for the Senate this time not to serve as the super conservative alternative, such as former House Speaker Bill O'Brien was for the past 2 years. I think so. As a result, the Senate, when it wrote its budget, actually adopted a lot of what the House had wanted for spending levels, particularly for health and human services and for higher education, and really left House Democrats with very few things to argue about. The Senate, Josh is right, at the end of the day, when it came to bargain, the Senate really had most of the cards. They had most of the demands and really had the upper hand in negotiations. But I think Democrats can certainly declare that some victories, particularly on the spending side.
And Dean, Republicans can point to the fact that there are no increased taxes, no increased fees as part of this budget.
Absolutely. It's interesting. If you were around the State House on Wednesday, there were backslapping and congratulations all around on both sides. I think the Hassan administration is going to work very hard to present this as a successful bipartisan compromise. And as we've already heard from Josh and Kevin, there's some truth to that. They got a lot of the spending that they wanted. Republicans, as you mentioned, didn't get the they held off on any tax increases other than a 10-cent increase in the cigarette tax, which was scheduled to occur anyway. But what's interesting to me is, as I think back over the discussion we've had in here in the last few months, the two biggest items, casino gambling, the $80 million licensing fee, which if you believed Governor Hassan a few months ago, was absolutely essential to having a balanced budget, and the expansion of Medicaid, which has now been put off until October 15th in a compromise move. Nonetheless, it's not at all clear to me that Republicans are going to be willing to go along with that. So I think it speaks to the real kind of limitations and constraints of divided government, that you know, if Governor Hassan had had a Democratic Senate, we might be doing something somewhat differently right now. But clearly, I think, as both Kevin and Josh have suggested, Republicans were very successful. You know, once we got past the spending, to focus on that you know, no increase in taxes or no revenue increases, which is a critical part of their platform. But, you know, Medicaid and casino gambling, not there as of now.
Well, it's also interesting, and I think to expand on something that Kevin said about decisions made in the Senate not to become, you know, a useful political tool for Democrats as the prior regime was under Speaker O'Brien in the House, that, you know, to some degree, both sides are choosing not to fight over this. And maybe this is a recognition that this budget, you know, more or less gets the job done. It may also be a recognition that the budget may not be the most fertile political ground to fight on in order to gain headway for the next election. And it is true that certainly I have never seen anything resembling a 24-0 vote on a budget in the state Senate. I'm not sure Kevin has. I mean, I don't think anyone has who's been covering the state House. And so that was very interesting. I mean, certainly people were bending over backwards to congratulate themselves on being exemplars of bipartisanship. And, you know, to Senator Moore's point, that wasn't always reflected in the rhetoric as this budget went through. But I guess you know, all's well that may end well. But this isn't over, as Dean mentions. The Medicaid expansion fight will be an interesting one, and it's going to be complicated as to how to get the votes to make that happen.
That's one of those things that lawmakers essentially agreed to disagree about, Kevin. And but now that's part of the state budget, this study committee that's going to report back, and then lawmakers will have to decide what to do next.
They will, and certainly the Democrats on this commission that's going to study Medicaid expansion sort of have the upper hand. There's going to be 9 members on the commission, and 5 of them are going to be appointed by Democrats, either Speaker of the House Terry Norelli or Governor Maggie Hassan, and 4 of them will be appointed by the Senate President Peter Bragdon. So so at least with the commission, in all likelihood, they'll be recommending some expansion. And I think some, at the end of the day, I think some expansion of Medicaid will occur. The real question is how it does occur, and that's where Senate Republicans certainly now have some negotiating room in which to try and get more of a private sector-driven expansion of Medicaid than what Governor Hassan had wanted.
That New Hampshire solution, as Peter Bragdon, the Senate President, has called it.
Right. I've talked to several legislators over the last week, and just trying to get a sense of what is it that actually needs to be studied? I mean, the complaint you've been hearing from Republicans is that the Obama administration may renege at some point on its promise to fully fund Medicaid over 3 years and then 90% after those first 3 years. So, you know, to some extent, if that's the real issue, at some point you have to take kind of a leap of faith that the money's going to be there. Now, there may be aspects that you can study about, you know, what if the money dries up? Can we once those people are on Medicaid, can there's just some other source of funding? But, you know, I'm someone who traditionally has been very skeptical of study commissions because at least at the federal level, it's typically the way to kick the issue, down the street a little bit until you figure out how to either block it or obstruct it in some other way. So I don't know, maybe Kevin or Josh know or not, you know, what it is exactly that needs to be studied, because the issue that I've heard is simply that, you know, the Obama administration is going to go back on their promise. And so I'm not sure what it is that they're going to study to kind of get around that fundamental, you either believe the government or you don't.
And that was something several Democrats pointed out during the debate. They said, look, the money's going to be there. Our decision is whether or not to accept it, and that it wouldn't necessarily go beyond that, Josh.
Well, it is interesting in that traditionally the attitude from both parties in New Hampshire has been to accept federal money and accept it quickly. and so, you know, part of this is a sort of a changing, you know, political climate within the Republican Party over the last, you know, 4 years, basically. But it is a valid question about how this is going to work down the line. It is complicated. It is, if you believe the report by the Lewin Group, it is $2.5 billion into the economy. That's a big number. And it is something that extends beyond this administration. I mean, we're looking, you know, 8 years out in terms of who's going to be left potentially holding the bag. And Democrats point out, and rightfully, that there is no record of the federal government reneging on promises when it comes to Medicaid funding. But there are examples that Republicans have really seized on. Special education is one we've heard sort of ad nauseum from the Senate president, that the federal government doesn't always live up to its commitments. And it's going to be interesting to see whether that rhetoric changes as we get closer to the ultimate decision.
Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're talking about some of the action at the New Hampshire State House this week, including passage of a new two-year state budget. After a short break, we're going to start talking about some of the other activity at the State House this week, including passage of changes to the state's voter ID law and a bill legalizing medical marijuana for certain patients. We'll talk about those, and we'll start taking your calls with questions and comments as well. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to us at exchange@nhpr.org. Much more to come. Stay with us. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. The U.S. Supreme Court has issued its final rulings of the session, including opinions on affirmative action, gay marriage, and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Join host Linda Wertheimer and legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg for an hour-long special that'll look at these rulings and reflect on the past year. SCOTUS in Review, tonight at 9 on NHPR. More of our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. It's the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, working to create opportunity and transform lives across the Granite State. Your community's loan fund, details at communityloanfund.org. And from Liberty's Utilities, helping homeowners convert oil or propane heating systems to natural gas before fall. Details on conversion programs at libertyutilities.com/east/warm. Welcome. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our guests for the hour, Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter, Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for The Telegraph of Nashua, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Again, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Before we move on to other legislative activity, I wanted to ask just a couple of quick questions to wrap up our discussion of the budget. Kevin Landrigan, as someone who's been through these negotiations a number of times, I'm sure you've heard the criticism of Governor Hassan's predecessor, John Lynch, who said he was too hands-off in these kinds of situations. I'm curious what people say about Governor Hassan's role in the negotiations that produced this budget.
Well, certainly with the divided government that Josh talked about, Governor Hassan's in a position that John Lynch was never in. That's sort of important to point out, that over the 8 years, Republicans either had total control or Democrats had total control. So it was a different dynamic for her certainly to deal with. I think in general, legislators, many legislators told me they liked Governor Hassan's style of being more conversant with them, giving them, particularly on other pieces of legislation, more of an indication early on in the process about how she felt about things. A couple of times during the negotiations, she came over personally on that last night where we met until about 4 in the morning when we had the deal. She met with both Senate President Peter Bragdon and Speaker Norelli for about an hour behind closed doors, and it was sort of after that meeting that things started to break. So we can certainly presume she played some part in bringing the parties together.
Here's an email we got from Christopher in Manchester. He says, even though a budget has been passed, I heard from a Democratic representative that there's no money for roads and bridges. How much of a shortfall is there, and where will that money come from?
That's actually, I was just about to mention that. I think one of the big question marks in this budget, and maybe Josh or Kevin can speak to the specifics of that question about the gap, but one of the kind of the bigger policy issues is this issue of transportation. And part of the debate, if you remember, over increasing the gas tax was to have some of the money, the additional revenue dedicated specifically to roads and bridges. And we're also seeing reports now that the I-93 expansion project is going to grind to a halt in 2015 because there's about a $250 million shortfall. So there are all these kinds of issues that are unresolved in terms of our roads and bridge infrastructure in the state, and this budget is still problematic in that respect, in part because the revenues are not increasing.
At times, it sounded like this budget was going to wind up being a choice between an increase in the gas tax, which is what House Democrats were pushing for, or legalizing a casino, which is what the state Senate was favoring. And in the end, neither of those was in the state budget.
No, and you know, Transportation Commissioner Chris Clement made a presentation earlier in the week where he laid out some of the looming issues that are going to face, such as the grinding the halt of 93 widening and other transportation issues involving bridges and their red line status and things that people who have followed this debate are familiar with. And it is true that we didn't really end up getting anywhere on this front. You could argue that maybe the House shot for too much by asking for 12 cents on the gas tax. Obviously, it failed. And on the flip side with the senators, Senator Morse was dead set on not having a gas tax and using casino revenue to pay for roads and bridges. Whether that would have added up to enough to really achieve anything as substantial as the gas tax is another question. But obviously both those failed, and there probably will be some appetite to revisit this in year two of the session, and it will be at a much smaller scale, though, than what was contemplated this year.
Kevin, you mentioned that Governor Hassan had been talking with lawmakers, being a bit more upfront perhaps than her predecessor, about her feelings on certain bills. And one example of that was in the state's medical marijuana bill, where the governor told lawmakers up front that she did not favor what was called the home grow provision. She wanted that removed from the bill. And in the final bill, there was no home grow provision.
That's right. And that's certainly one of the major accomplishments this year, to get medical marijuana. It's something that supporters have been working on for over a decade, really, some of them. And in the past, both Democratic and Republican-led legislatures have passed these bills before, and former Governor John Lynch has vetoed them. So when Governor Hassan made clear her positions about medical marijuana and the kind of bill she was willing to support, it was difficult for supporters to swallow that there wouldn't be a homegrown provision, but they certainly want something to occur, and this bill will allow that to happen. It's important to point out now that we have a medical marijuana law, when Governor Hassan signs it, the bill becomes effective on passage. It takes effect right away. but it's probably going to be 18 months to 2 years before these dispensaries are going to be up and running.
And that's what the home grow supporters were trying to say, that this would bridge the gap.
Some of them were hoping for some sort of flexibility in the final version that would allow for home grow during that interval until the four dispensaries were up and running. But it is true that Governor Hassan did get involved when it had passed the House. Her legal counsel essentially sat down with the chair of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee and says, you know, this is what the governor is willing to accept. And, you know, she made her point clear and made it early enough so that people could get it done. It wasn't as Governor Lynch did, certainly on a couple of bills where he was after it had been much deeper in the process.
The same-sex marriage law, I think, was one.
Yes, yes, that one was the big one. So, you know, again, this was something where people did come together, and people who support, you know, home grow or say that, you know, we can revisit this. The important thing is to get it on the books. New Hampshire would be the 19th state, I believe, and it is interesting that Governor Hassan did support home grow as a senator, but sometimes your perspective changes when you're in the corner office.
Another bill that came up with a compromise, it looked like it wasn't going to reach a compromise at one point, was modifications to the state's voter ID law that originally passed with the Republican majorities in the previous legislature. Many Democrats, Dean, wanted the entire law repealed but ended up backing these modifications. So what changes here that wouldn't have if this modified bill hadn't passed?
Right. The issue is that the original piece of legislation passed under the O'Brien legislature's two-stage implementation of stricter voter ID laws. The second phase was supposed to come into effect in this September 2013, which would be a shorter list of acceptable IDs, photo IDs. If you didn't have a photo ID, you'd have to fill out an affidavit and be photographed by a poll worker. As you mentioned, the Democrats wanted to repeal that. It was tabled in the Senate, I believe. So the compromise they came up with, and this I think it passed the Senate 14-10 with three Republicans voting in favor. Republicans were not thrilled about this, but the outcome is that at least for now, student IDs will remain valid, and voters over 65 can use expired driver's licenses, and the photo taking of people without IDs is going to be postponed in about 2015. So, you know, this is in the end, this was the best they could get in terms of a compromise for Democrats. Two things: I don't think it will change the desire of Democrats to repeal the entire thing at some point. It's part of a larger national debate about voter ID and whether or not it's discriminatory in terms of who gets to vote. And the other issue is I think Republicans continue to be focused on the domicile issue, to basically set up a system in which students who are only in the state to go to school won't necessarily be able to vote in New Hampshire unless they meet certain residency requirements. And this is, you know, I remember the same debate about students voting in congressional elections, you know, when I was in college 30 years ago. So this has been an ongoing debate for many decades. I don't think we've heard the last of it, but I think Democrats feel like this is a reasonable compromise for now.
And let's hear from a Republican state senator. This is Russell Prescott speaking on his reaction to the modified voter ID bill, which he voted against.
If we allow student identifications from colleges, trade schools, high schools, we have advocated government's responsibility to determine what is legitimate verification.
That was State Senator Russell Prescott, a Republican, speaking on the modified voter ID bill. And Kevin Landrigan, a number of Republicans, including one who helped negotiate this compromise bill, voted against it in part because they said it was taking all of the teeth out of the voter ID bill. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, that certainly was their perspective. And as Dean pointed out, this is kind of part of a larger narrative about between the two parties, both here and nationally, that Republicans want more voter verification at the polls. Democrats insist it's just another way to try and suppress the vote among student voters, among minority voters, low-income voters. What was interesting to me, as you pointed out in the opening of this topic, that at one point, there was no agreement. Both sides on this voter ID compromise sort of walked away and said, "We're not gonna agree to anything." So the existing law with this picture-taking component Dean talked about is going to take effect. I think what happened here essentially was that, as we talked about at the beginning, Senate Republicans had all the cards on the budget and essentially got what they wanted from this budget. And I think House Speaker Terry Norelli helped negotiate sort of a grand bargain for House Democrats to get what they wanted on a number of other issues other than the budget. So it was noteworthy, for example, that the negotiations on voter ID and a number of these other bills occurred the day after the budget deal took effect. So it really looked as if there was this agreement where, okay, Senate Republicans, you're going to get the budget you want. House Democrats, we're going to give you bills you want, such as voter ID. And the accommodations to the Affordable Care Act that Democrats wanted, and also an immunization bill that was a real favorite among House Democrats.
Because on its own, Josh, the voter ID, as it stood, the next phase of the implementation would have taken place in September if there had been no deal, and that's what Republicans would have preferred to begin with.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think to Kevin's point, it may be telling that one of the three Republicans to vote in favor of this was Senate President Peter Bragg, and the other two being Bob Odell of Leominster and Nancy Stiles of Hampton. This one is a tough one because the Senate had the law that is on the books right now, the law that where the more stringent requirements would take effect in September, that was a product of a compromise between the Republican Senate and the more conservative Republican House under Speaker O'Brien. And what the Senate had wanted was more or less, you know, what we've got now. It was the House that had insisted on these tighter provisions. And Russ Prescott, the person who's complaining about this, was actually somebody who supported and drafted and negotiated, you know, effectively with city and town clerks to get the Senate bill through. And so he had formed a coalition. The Republicans of the House wanted something more conservative. They ended up getting it. But once something's on the books, if you're a Republican, it's going to be quite hard for you to go to your constituents, your party, and say, oh, I'm in favor of a more relaxed voter ID law. It's just very difficult.
That's a very good point. I do think that sort of the on-the-ground activists on the front lines will view this as a defeat for Republicans because big numbers of students are going to be able to vote. And at least now, generationally, that has favored Democrats in recent elections. Yeah.
Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're taking a look at the big New Hampshire news stories of the week. And we invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send a comment or question through our Facebook page. As the legislative session draws to a close, and you mentioned a few possibilities here, are there big bills, Dean, that lawmakers didn't finish work on that might come up again next year? Or, you know, obviously the casino legislation is a perennial bill, but are there others that you might watch going forward?
It's funny. I asked that exact question to a senator the other day, and seemed pretty happy that they had kind of, at least from the Republican perspective, they had kind of hit on all the issues that they wanted to hit upon. I do think for Democrats, you know, for example, the voter ID law, if they're going to attempt to try to repeal that again, I think casino gambling is going to be a huge issue. There's some talk about reviving a study commission to look at kind of the regulatory aspects of it. And my sense from listening to Governor Hassan is that they may rethink some aspects of the bill, like the bidding process and what it means for some of the towns and other towns and areas in the state. And then obviously Medicaid expansion. So, you know, I think there's a general sense from everything we've talked about that they actually covered a lot of ground this year. You know, medical marijuana, a budget agreement, a compromise on voter ID. You know, the tax issues may come up again. You know, we'll see. But overall, my sense from talking to people this past week was that, well, they, you know, except for these couple of issues we've mentioned, they've sort of pretty much, you know, touched on it. One area where I think there may be some attempt at kind of a little more cohesion is energy policy. There's been this kind of fragmentation. You know, there's kind of these sustainable energy issues going on with windmill projects around the state have been struggling. We're going to talk about Northern Pass. There are some issues with kind of traditional fossil fuels and in the environment. And, you know, Governor Hassan has said she would prefer to have a more cohesive policy. Republicans have said that there needs to be a better balance. So that may be something that comes up. But you know, energy is typically one of those things that kind of is third or fourth on the list when, you know, the economy and healthcare, and then maybe you get to energy a little bit later on. But my sense is maybe people are just burned out at this point. But not a lot of huge things on the horizon.
Well, let's pick up with Northern Pass because it was yesterday that the officials behind that project announced a new proposed transmission route. Originally, the company had said they would announce a route last December. Several other deadlines came and went, but now there's a proposal. They put it forward. What's notable here, Kevin, about that makes this different from the routes that they've proposed in the past?
Well, certainly the biggest change is they would bury some of the transmission lines up in the very northern part of this project as it comes through Canada in towns like Stewartstown and Colebrook. There was discussion at one point about them actually bringing the transmission lines through the Connecticut River headwaters up in that part of the state, which is very protected property that was negotiated by the state in a bipartisan way. Both former Senator and Governor Judd Gregg and Senator Jeanne Shaheen had kind of authored an op-ed that was very critical of that notion. This ultimately didn't do that, and I think that certainly made environmentalists happy, but this doesn't go far enough as far as opponents in Northern Pass.
Well, I was going to bring that up because opponents have been saying for years, bury the lines, and the company has always said that would be cost prohibitive. It would be way too expensive. So why only 8 miles then of this proposal goes into that? Is this just a nod to those opponents saying we're trying to meet you halfway?
Well, I think opponents would certainly say they're not being met halfway, but they consider it progress that PSNH and the Northern Pass Project, which had said we can't bury the lines, are now saying, well, we can at least bury 8 miles worth of lines. And this route, which heads a little bit more east, it's going to cost another $200 million onto the project, and it comes on the heels of this battle between the utility and conservation groups in terms of snapping up land that would either facilitate or block the route. And this comes on the heels of a number of purchases and purchases of conservation easements on both sides. And so this is ongoing. Neither side, the Northeast Utilities and PSNH are definitely eager to move forward. And they rolled out, they have business groups in support at this rollout with Gary Long, PSNH's president, and they had unions there, and they had some municipal officials. The other side is certainly dogged and are going to fight this, and this is a long way from over.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think in terms of opposition, the issue is that for some people, this was simply a question of property value. So you're concerned about having these power lines near your property. So you either move them to the other part of the state or you bury them. That solves the problem. But there is a whole group of people opposed to this on sort of larger kind of ideological or conservation or principle grounds, what have you. You know, we saw their reaction yesterday. Sort of a collective yawn, and they're going to continue fighting. So the question is, how much of a difference will this make in terms of people opposed to it? And I don't have a sense of that yet. I think for some people it was simply, not in my backyard. But I think for a whole other group of people, this is kind of a larger issue about the future of energy policy.
The debate may continue then. Well, our discussion will continue after a short break. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We invite your calls with comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Coming up, we'll talk about more of the New Hampshire news of the week. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from AARP, presenting You've Earned a Say, a community discussion on solutions to keep Medicare and Social Security strong, inviting Granite Staters to join the conversation at aarp.org/NH. And from the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem, presenting David Wax Museum, Saturday, July 6 at 8, fusing traditional Mexican folk with American roots. Tickets at bethlehemcolonial.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Virginia Prescott, Word of Mouth puts your finger on the pulse of whirlwind trends in pop culture, technology, and the arts at a new time, Monday through Thursdays at 2 p.m. starting July 1st. You can listen on your radio, on your phone with the NHPR app, and online at nhpr.org. Join me for Word of Mouth at its new time, 2 p.m. starting next Monday on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-892-6477, 800-892-NHPR or send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. With us on our panel today, Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter, Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for the Nashua Telegraph, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. We've been talking about Northern Pass, and I wanted to ask just one more question. We've talked about the PSNH officials, the Northern Pass backers, obviously in favor of the new proposed route, and the traditional Northern Pass opponents speaking out against it. What have New Hampshire officials, Governor Haas and the U.S. senators said, Kevin Landrigan, about this new proposal, at least so far?
Yeah, certainly Governor Haas and Senator Shaheen have been pretty united in their response, essentially, which was that we appreciate this desire on the part of public service and Northeast Utilities to bury some of the lines, but we'd essentially like to see what the costs and the impacts would be if we were to bury all of these lines. I think one of the other arguments that Governor Haasen has been making for some time about Northern Pass, and I think it's one of the reasons why the support for this project is kind of outweighed by the opposition, is that at the end of the day, Northern Pass right now is not intended to deliver a lot of power to New Hampshire. The two problems this project has in my mind politically is, one, as far as energy capacity concerns, this power really isn't needed for the energy grid. And the other problem is, in New Hampshire, there's no plan for this power to be folded into our energy needs and therefore lower the cost to consumers. And that's one thing Governor Haasen has been very vocal about, and I think will continue to hold her back from supporting this project.
And I noticed that the governor did sign a bill this week that would let the state study the way that it studies these kinds of projects, which includes Northern Pass, but it's not limited to it, the site evaluation process. Josh?
Well, and that's one question that some have had about whether or not this new route would be subject to the considerations contemplated under that bill, whether or not that this proposal was a way to get it in under the current regime rather than under what may be a revamped site evaluation process coming, you know, about a year away or something.
Let's take a call now from one of our listeners. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Mike is calling in. Hi, Mike. You're on the exchange.
Good morning, sirs. Thanks for taking my call. I am a state worker with the NHDOT, and with the shortfalls that are coming forward, what we're being informed of in the next couple of years is there's going to be another group of layoffs coming in, around 330 employees from the DOT, and the gas tax would have solely funded us and taken that off the books. But what it seems that's being presented to us is that it's not a gas tax that the people of New Hampshire are going to see at the pumps. It's a gas surcharge to the fuel companies. And we're wondering why the verbiage on that isn't being brought forward to everybody to make them aware that our roads and everything would be funded with this, and we wouldn't be paying for it at the pumps.
That's an interesting question, Mike. Thanks for the call. Dean, it's a little more – it's not sure. – there's more to it than nomenclature, but that's a part of it, tax versus surcharge.
Yeah, and I've heard that. I've heard that exact same argument, and what opponents typically say is that the companies that get the surcharge will figure out a way to pass it along to consumers at the pump, that in reality it's a distinction without a difference. Now, that may not be a fair argument or an accurate argument, but kind of from a political or strategy perspective, that's been the argument that I've heard, that you can add a surcharge and it's going to show up at the pumps eventually.
Yeah, one of the kind of complicated parts of this debate about infrastructure spending really is what happens when you raise a gas tax. Do prices go up commensurate with that increase? Do they go up more? Do they actually go up less? As our Transportation Commissioner Chris Clymer pointed out, Vermont raised its gas tax almost 6 cents in May, and they reported – their governor reported that gas tax prices went up about 3 cents per gallon at the pump in gas stations in Vermont. But as a result, gas prices on the Vermont border at New Hampshire gas stations went up about 3 cents as well to actually fill in that gap so that these companies in New Hampshire could realize additional revenue as Vermont was realizing additional revenue. And so that's one of the reasons why this debate often gets kind of diluted, because it's very unclear what's going to happen with prices if you raise the gas tax.
Mike, thanks so much for your call. I wanted to turn attention for a moment to something that happened outside the State House. Last week, a group called Mayors Against Illegal Guns held a rally outside the State House in Concord. And Josh, the story of that rally was not what they had intended it to be.
No, it wasn't. The rally drew a counter-protest of gun rights advocates. And, you know, no one came out of this looking too hot. The Mayors Against Illegal Guns, part of the presentation was a reading of lists of victims of gun violence. And, you know, among the list, among the names listed was Tamerlan Tsarnaev, one of the Boston marathon bombers, and, you know, several other unsavory people, including, the policeman who sort of went rogue out in California and sort of holed himself up in a cab and shot a number of people. And on the other side of this, some of the, gun rights advocates were, beyond boisterous at this thing, yelling at some of the speakers. And one of these fellows ended up being tasered by the Concord police. In the wake of this, the Bloomberg Mayors Against Gun Groups has apologized for using this list, but it's kicked up sort of a little bit of a political fight between GOP Chair Jennifer Horn and the mayor of Dover, who was the only New Hampshire mayor on this list, who remains on the list. Donnelly Lozo, the mayor of Nashua, jumped off the list in the wake of this. So this was an ongoing spat.
Dean. Yeah, and there was just recently, in the last day or two, I believe, the State Associations of Chiefs of Police and Sheriffs sent an open letter to Mayor Bloomberg saying that this list was deeply shameful because it had a variety of criminals and others who were listed as gun deaths. And so that was a big misstep by this Mayors Against Illegal Guns organization. The question is, did they just not catch this? Is this some sort of ideological statement about the universality of the problems with gun deaths? It's not clear to me, but it's certainly the tasering incident got a lot of attention. But I think in kind of the larger national debate, and this is a highly contested issue around the country, obviously, I think this is a big problem for this particular group, that the list was the way that it was, and it's been now, it's gone viral all over the country, that this is sort of, these mayors are soft on criminals, essentially, and that they view this as just as bad as a law-abiding person being killed.
And speaking of large national debates with New Hampshire implications, of course, we saw the two U.S. Supreme Court rulings this week on same-sex marriage, one overturning the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and the other speaking to California's Proposition 8. A very complicated ruling, but essentially it says that same-sex marriage can go forward in that state. We talked about it this week on The Exchange, and one of our guests was a former Democratic representative and state senator, Jim Splain, who authored that law. And here was his reaction to the Supreme Court's rulings.
With California, some 30% of Americans now will be living in states where there is marriage equality. I think we're going to have to see the adventure continue, the cause continue, to make sure that we have marriage equality in all parts of this country.
That was Jim Splain, former Democratic state representative and senator, who authored this state's same-sex marriage law. And Kevin Landrigan, he said that the adventure is likely to continue, but is it likely to continue in this state where same-sex marriage has been on the books for a number of years and polls show a fair bit of support for it?
Yeah, they do. I certainly wouldn't be surprised if social conservatives try to take another run at repealing this law, but they certainly don't have the votes in the New Hampshire House to do that, and Governor Hassett would be a big opponent of that. So while this debate isn't over, certainly the outcome is not in doubt. Same-sex marriage remains pretty popular in this state, and probably more popular now than when former Governor John Lynch signed the law.
Josh, I believe Jennifer Horn, the chair of the New Hampshire Republican State Committee, she said that while the Republican platform in this state remains committed to what she called, I believe, traditional marriage, she said that we recognize there are good people on both sides of the debate. That's a different sort of framing of the issue than what we might have heard 4 or 5 years ago, even.
Well, certainly, and I think it's a recognition of the fact that it would be politically unpopular, and it's not. It would unlikely be seen by any, reasonable observer of politics to, be the GOP's way to put its best foot forward in New Hampshire to try to repeal a law that's on the books and, take away rights that are already granted. But it is remarkable how quickly this issue has moved. I'm sure Kevin remembers the hand-wringing that went on when this bill made its way through the legislature. And it was really one of then-Senator Maggie Hassan's largest accomplishments. She was really in the key person in brokering this deal, and it came after the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, former Senator Deb Reynolds, originally voted saying, "My constituents aren't ready for this." And then, her vote flipped. They managed to get it through, and Governor Lynch signed it, and...
And here we are in 2015.
And, and you look back even further. I mean, DOMA was under President Bill Clinton. Joe Biden voted for it. Things have moved fast on this issue.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I was going to mention that, this Defense of Marriage Act, that the part was just wiped away by one of the decisions. That was a Clinton error piece of legislation. Politico did an interesting piece, I believe, where they went back and they looked at what Democrats said about the Defense of Marriage Act in 96 compared to where they are now. And it's just remarkable. And I remember not that long ago, 2004, the de facto Democratic position on gay marriage was civil unions.
Civil unions.
Right. And even President Obama, 2008, his opposition to gay marriage. And we can get into all kinds of debates about whether that was sort of his real feelings or political posturing. Nonetheless, in the last 20 years, the change has just been remarkable. I think there's a recognition among a lot of Republicans that this is if you look at polling data, particularly among younger voters, sort of 18 to 29, even among conservative youth or Republican youth, just this issue doesn't resonate the way it has for an older generation. So I think this is part of a very rapidly changing landscape on gay marriage.
Here's another change that we haven't talked about this week. The state has received from the federal government a waiver under the federal No Child Left Behind law. This is another one of these cases, Kevin Landrigan, that took a long time to come together. At one point, the state wasn't going to seek a waiver, and then they did, but the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, passed them over several times. And here we are now. What exactly do we know about what the feds have granted here?
Well, I think in many school districts, they've been really upset by No Child Left Behind and how rigid the requirements are for it. They were really looking for flexibility in terms of complying with the law, and certainly a lot of problems with the fact that that school districts that have underperforming students could be sanctioned pretty heavily by the federal government, and that's what they're looking to essentially get out from under. The state of New Hampshire and many states essentially want to be able to say that if we have underperforming schools, we should be able to adopt an action plan to improve them, not have one foisted on us by the federal government.
And a lot of the tension in the negotiations was on who would get to design these evaluation systems. Would it be the state,
yep,
or would it be local school districts? This state was looking for a more flexible model where it would be the local school districts. Right. But there's that tension just written into that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question that we have a tradition here in New Hampshire of certainly local control when it comes to education, and I think that's what folks here were looking for.
Once again, the Annie E. Casey Foundation has released its annual Kids Count report. It ranks New Hampshire first among states in child well-being. The report shows improvement, Dean, in education. Preschool participation is up. There are more high school students who are graduating on time. But it says child poverty rate is growing and the overall child health is declining. So
we're still at the top
of the list, but there's some troubling news in there too.
Right, and I know plenty of people around the state who were quite happy to see that New Hampshire was still number one in overall child well-being. But the foundation did point to these two areas, as you mentioned, the poverty rate and child health. I think the poverty rate is up to 12% in 2011. It had been 9% in 2005. So you have this increase in the poverty rate. And then child health, we dropped from 10th to 16th. Last year we were 10th. This year we're 16th. So these are potential red flags. It has to do with kind of the changing demographic nature of the state. Some urban areas get an influx of new populations, and that relates back to the No Child Left Behind, where a lot of the issue with failing schools are dealing with new populations. English may be an issue, et cetera, et cetera. Although it does say that we're doing better in education, and particularly math and English. So there's some generally good news, but it does raise these two red flags.
And lastly, this one's a little off the beaten path, but a sister city disillusionment, perhaps. Last year, Kevin Portsmouth announced it was looking to set up a sister city relationship with Sant'Arcangelo, Italy. And I know we all looked that up to see exactly where that was, in northern Italy. But this week, apparently, that may not happen. A little protocol issue, it sounds like.
There's it's always interesting with a lot of these sister relationships that have to occur. Very often you run into domestic problems in the country you're trying to align yourself with, so it's not as easy a marriage as you might assume it's going to be.
And that's how it seems to play out, although it sounds like Portsmouth officials are saying that they're going to try again to restore the balance and see if they can get sisterhood back together. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time, so I just want to say a big thank you to each of you for spending the hour with us. Josh Rogers, thanks as always.
Oh, you're welcome, Brady.
Josh Rogers is NHPR's senior political reporter. Kevin Landrigan, great to talk with you.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Kevin Landrigan is a longtime political reporter for the Nashua Telegraph. And Dean Spiliotis, thanks so much as well.
Sure thing. Thanks, Brady.
It's Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. The conversation continues on our website, nhpr.org. We hope you'll post a comment there and join the discussion about the issues of the week. Again, that's at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we bring you some of our favorite Exchange shows of the past year. We begin with the question, should government play a role in our growing obesity problem? Issues from nutritional labeling to